Okay, so I'll talk about strongly system which spin orbit interactions are strong and what might happen when you add correlation effects. So most of the part of the talk will be an overview, and the part of it which will cover some of the work we have done, it will mainly be based on this preprint done with my postdoc Ari Turner at UC Berkeley. But we actually had a very fruitful collaboration with these two people, Shangang Wan at Nanjing and Sergei Savrasov at UC Davis, who actually do ab initio calculations of real materials. So some of the ideas that we had, we could make contact with a very specific set of materials. Okay, so so that'll be most of the talk, but hopefully I'll have time to tell you about these other two pieces of work, and I think that's where there's some connection, maybe slightly more connection to the theme of this workshop. It turns out some of the ideas we had over here came out by looking at the entanglement spectrum of some free fermion problems. So that's sort of a, maybe a historical development, but I'll tell you a little bit about how we can classify different topological phases of at least of weakly interacting systems or non-interacting systems using this entanglement spectrum. Okay, so as motivation for my talk, let me remind you about some recent developments in condensed matter physics, where people looked at essentially band insulators, where you can safely ignore a lot of the correlation effects, but where there was very strong spin orbit interactions. Okay, and some qualitatively new physics was found, the physics of these topological insulators. So in two dimensions, these are called quantum spin Hall insulators sometimes. And in three dimensions, they're often called Z2 topological insulators. So these are really new phases, and what's more, they're phases that are distinguished from ordinary insulators by their band topology, not by an order parameter, but by something else, which is intrinsically quantum. Okay, and the important ingredient over here is time reversal symmetry. So they're really sharply defined in the presence of time reversal symmetry. And one way to kind of point out a new phenomenon that's accompanies these new phases is that they always have surface states. Okay, so they are insulating the bulk, but they have surface states. But these surface states are actually impossible. So if you take a two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional insulator, it's impossible to get the same spectrum in a purely two-dimensional system. Okay, so it's the bulk is critical to getting the particular kind of surface states that you have, and there's been some very nice experimental realization of all of these theoretical ideas in mercury telluride quantum wells. That's the 2D version, and more recently in these three-dimensional materials. Okay. Okay, so the idea is that you know, people came up with this new physics, looking at systems which have strong spin-orbit coupling. Okay, so what happens if you were to look at correlated systems where the electron-electron interaction is very important? Could we get some qualitatively new physics there as well if we added this new ingredient? Okay, so in fact, if you look at past work on correlated systems, correlated materials, there's been a lot of very exciting physics that's been discovered there. But all of these have been discovered in materials where you can neglect the spin-orbit interaction. Okay, so really, I'd argue that the physics of strongly correlated systems, which have where the spin-orbit interaction is a non-trivial ingredient, that really hasn't been looked at very carefully. And I'll tell you about some opportunities, already some interesting experimental and theoretical ideas, which point to new physics in this regime. Okay, so you know, the physics of correlated systems. The really exciting advances were discovery of high-temperature superconductivity in the cuprates. So these sort of this row of the transition metal compounds, the copper over here, gives you this high-temperature superconductivity under certain conditions. There's interesting magnetism that comes out again from these, typically from these elements, colossal magnetoresistance in the manganites, you know, quantum spin liquid physics, and some. Frustrated magnets. Okay, now, if you wanted to look at systems that have strong spin-orbit correlations, the spin-orbit interactions increase as you go down the periodic table. Okay, you have heavier atoms, stronger electric fields. Ultimately, that gives you bigger spin-orbit interactions. Okay, so if you want to combine correlation physics and spin-orbit, you really want to look at this row of the periodic table. Okay, so they're transition metal systems. They have, for example, d orbitals where the electron correlation is important, but they also have strong spin-orbit interactions. Okay, so I'll in fact focus on one particular entry over here, iridium. So it'll turn out to be a particularly simple system where there's already quite a lot of work, where there's an interesting interplay between spin-orbit physics and the correlation physics of these 5D electrons. Okay, so why is it particularly simple in this context? So if you go through the physics of a single iridium ion in an octahedral arrangement of oxygens, that's the typical unit that keeps appearing. So you split the electronic levels of this d orbital, the usual splitting, T2g and eg. But the new step that you have to include over here is the presence of spin orbit interactions. Okay, and so these T2g orbitals get further split into a set of four orbitals. You can think of them as total angular momentum 3/2, a combination of the spin and the orbital angular momentum, giving you these four states. These tend to be completely filled. And so the active orbital is this one, just a pair of orbitals, where there's a total spin of 1/2. Okay, so this looks a lot like a Hubbard model. You have a pair of levels, and there's one electron occupying these two levels. You're at half filling. Okay, but the big difference from the regular Hubbard model, these two levels are not spin up and spin down. There's some combination of spin and angular momentum. This is sort of a picture of what these orbitals might look like, combination of Lz equal to 0 and Lz equal to 1 with different spin combinations. Okay, so so you might expect some new physics coming out over here. So I'll tell you about three different systems where we believe there's something interesting going on. The first is a square lattice made up of these iridium atoms. So it's really an analog of the cuprate materials. and there's been quite a lot of study on this, experimental study. The other is the honeycomb lattice, the iridium ions forming the sides of a honeycomb lattice. And there's a very nice observation that this might actually realize a quantum spin liquid coming from theory. Okay, so it turns out it maps very closely. It might end up mapping very closely to this so-called Kitaev model, where a spin liquid ground state is known to exist. Okay, but most of my talk will be about the iridium atoms forming the sides of this pyrochlore lattice. Okay, so the pyrochlore lattice is a famous lattice. It has these corner-sharing tetrahedra. And the iridium sites are, of course, at these corners. So it's known, well known to be a highly frustrated lattice. And what I'll argue is that you might end up getting a couple of new phases over here. I'll explain these terms when we get to that. Okay, but first let me review these other two systems because I think there's something interesting and there's an opportunity for the systems to be looked at more closely. Okay, so this is an extract from an experimental paper on the square lattice material. So this was found to be magnetically ordered, and the pattern of magnetic order, if you sort of neglect this little canting, is essentially the same as in the parent compound of the cuprates. Okay, it's antiferromagnetic order, and the experimental technique that was used to verify this was actually X-rays. You normally don't think of X-rays as being a probe of the magnetism, but it turns out that in these iridium systems, you can really use X-rays to probe the magnetism. Again, it's a consequence of the strong spin-orbit interactions. And you can verify, in fact, that you should think of these orbitals where these electrons are localized as being really total angular momentum 1/2. Okay, so so a big question over here is what happens with doping? There have been some theoretical proposals saying that we should expect very similar physics as what happens in the copper oxide materials if we could actually dope the system. Okay, so far there's not been very much progress experimentally, but this might well be another playground to look at the same kind of physics as in the cuprates. Okay, so the second example that I gave was this the iridium atoms forming a honeycomb lattice. So in this case, as was analyzed by these two people, what they pointed out is that because the bonds between the iridium sites are have this particular geometry, the 90-degree bonds, if you work out what the spin Hamiltonian is, so these are insulators at low temperatures, you essentially just have the only degree of freedom at each site is which of those two orbitals the electron occupies. Okay, so it's like a spin-half problem. If you work out what the spin Hamiltonian is, if you didn't have any spin orbit interactions, you'd simply end up with this Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Okay, now that is one of the ingredients in this Hamiltonian, but it turns out there's another term as well. And in fact, in simple models, it's really this term that dominates. Okay, and the term that you get is an unusual term. Depending on the direction of this bond on the honeycomb lattice, you either have the SC-SE spin coupling, the SX-SX, or the SY-SY spin coupling. Okay, so actually, I've seen such a model before. It was proposed by Kitaev, essentially out of nowhere, as a model that he could solve and show to have a quantum spin-liquid ground state. And for a long time, it was thought that this was a very unnatural model. It's great that he can solve it and, you know, exhibit all of this beautiful spin-liquid physics, but it was really not believed to have any physical basis. Okay, but somehow, very naturally, because of the strong spin-orbit interaction, you naturally end up with this as being, at least in some simple models, the dominant magnetic exchange term. Okay, so if indeed this was the largest term in the Hamiltonian, the only relevant term, you should expect no magnetic order. Experimentally, some magnetic order is seen, but at a very depressed temperature, okay, at a much lower temperature than you would have guessed if you just look at the strength of the magnetic interactions in the system. Okay, so I think there's a lot of interesting physics over here that we'll see more about in the future. Also, this is just one of a family of materials. You can vary the first element and change the physics. Okay, so now let me come to the main part of my talk, which is systems where these iridium atoms live on the sides of a pyrochlore lattice. Okay, by the way, feel free to interrupt with questions. In fact, if there are any questions about the introductory part, I think this may be a good time to ask before I... Yeah, question.
What is the scale of exchange?
For the honeycomb? Okay, so this experimental paper has shows that there's a Curie-Weiss law. And so the Curie-Weiss temperature is antiferromagnetic and looks like it's around 100 Kelvin. But the magnetic ordering temperature is like 10 Kelvin. Yeah, so it's... Yeah, the nature of the magnetic order is still not known. That's something that we should, you know, I'm sure there are experiments planned for that to figure out exactly what. The, yeah.
Perhaps deviation from Heisenberg form would be evident even at high temperatures.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But you know, this is fairly symmetric thing. So, but the sign, you might think you would see the sign of this exchange.
I guess the same question. The Curie-Weiss would be sensitive to the combination of JK and.
That's right. Yeah.
Is it just a pure sum, or?
Well, you have to work it out what it is. It's something. It's something like a sum, but you have to weigh them because this comes with only one component, right? Okay, so now let me talk about this family, which you have some variety over here because you can change the A site. And unlike the previous two examples that I talked about, which are very good insulators, this actually turns out to be, it really depends whether this is insulating or not. And the reason we got interested in this system is due to a paper by Dima Pessin and Leon, who suggested that this material might actually realize a topological insulator. Okay, so this might actually be an example of the kind of phase I talked about in the first slide, a material which has surface states, which you can never realize in any two-dimensional system, but which also has strong correlations. Okay, and it'd be very nice to combine those two. And they did this using a very simple tight binding model and showed that the structure of this lattice is such that it's very likely that it might end up being in this phase. Okay, so as I mentioned before, an important ingredient to getting this topological insulator phase is that you shouldn't have magnetic order. Okay, it should be a time reversal symmetric system. So we wanted to figure out what interactions do to the system. So it'll turn out we actually have a conclusion that's different from theirs. We, when you put in all the details about the of this particular system, But it was very helpful to have this guidance to go and look at the system. Okay, there's some physics that's similar to, but not the same as this topological insulator physics. Okay, so let me just have one slide about the experiments. There are not a whole lot of experiments, but it gave us some guidance in trying to figure out what actually happens in these systems. So the first thing that people observed in this class of materials is that they're not necessarily very good insulators. Okay, it really depends what the first atom is. We can play around with that. So for some of these choices, this is a plot of the resistivity as a function of temperature. You have a good metal. It doesn't really, the resistivity is not very large at low temperatures. But in the others, it seems to rise, looks insulating-like, but it's never a very good insulator. Okay, so example, in this particular case, this A is this compound yttrium. It's insulating-like, but not terribly insulating. Okay? So the understanding was that depending on what choice you make over here, you change some aspect of the crystal structure, which increases the correlations. Okay, so the more strongly correlated you are, the more likely you are to be in the insulating phase. And the second thing that is known from experiments is that there is some sort of magnetic transition that occurs in these systems, especially the ones that look insulating-like. So the magnetic transition temperature is over here. It's 150 Kelvin. It's a slightly odd magnetic signature. You get some sort of hysteresis depending on whether you feel cool or measure the susceptibility. Once you're in the low temperature phase, you get different susceptibilities, but it's not the same as a ferromagnet. Okay, so there's some magnetic signature, but it's not quite what you'd expect from a ferromagnet. Okay, so the thing we took away from this is that it's likely these materials have magnetic order, and that depending on the strength of correlations, you can either get a metallic phase or an insulating phase. Okay, so what was found from these calculations that we did with the so-called LDA plus U calculations? Let me say a couple of words about this method. So in some ways, it's much less sophisticated than the kind of computational methods we've heard in this workshop. It's really a variational method over Slater determinant states. Okay, so correlations are only included in some. In the kind of magnetic ordering patterns that you pick, but it does include a lot of the realistic physics of these systems. Okay, so what this is especially good at telling you is, for example, do you have magnetic order in this set of materials? And in the magnetically ordered phase, let's say you actually find such order, what is the nature of the electronic structure? Is it an insulator? Is it a metal? And so on. Okay, so what was found from these calculations is that, in fact, magnetic order is very strongly preferred. Okay, and so it's not the simple time reversal symmetric topological insulator that people have discussed. And if you try different patterns, it's really not clear on this pyroclore lattice what the pattern of the magnetic ordering should be. Okay, so you try various patterns, and the one that was turned out to win is this pattern where all the spins point into the center. All of them point out of the center of this tetrahedron. Okay, so it's an Ising order parameter. It's either all in or all out. So it breaks time reversal symmetry. It's a magnetic ordering pattern, but it preserves the inversion symmetry. Okay, so that's going to be important. We're going to use that quite a bit in understanding these states. Okay, so you know that it's magnetically ordered, but the question is it metallic or is it insulated? Okay, and again, this is something that you can learn from these techniques. So what you find is that really depends on how strong the correlations are. Okay, so there's a parameter in these calculations, U, which really allows you to encode the how correlated these systems are. It's a parameter that you don't know very well, but you can tune it. Okay, and if this correlation parameter is small, let's say it's just switch it off, you get a metal, you get a density of states at the Fermi energy. If this is large, you find that it's insulated. Okay, so the caricature of this large U state is really just take electrons, fix them on sites, and have them to point along, have the spins to point along these different directions. Okay, you can really understand all of the structure over here as perturbing around that state. Okay, so the real question is what happens in between? Okay, so you can make sort of a guesstimate for what this U value is. It's roughly midway between these two extremes. It's about 1.5 electron volts. Okay, so what do you expect in between? Okay, so if you look at the electronic spectrum, so maybe I should have mentioned this is energy. This is the typical kind of plot that you have. So you have a three-dimensional Brillouin zone, but you simply take lines in this three-dimensional Brillouin zone and plot the energies of the bands. Okay, and these are some high symmetry lines. So this is what you find at at the value of U that we think is relevant. It kind of looks insulating. The Fermi energy lies in at an energy where there are no band crossings. Okay, but if you make a more careful analysis, for example, if you look at the quantum numbers of these filled states, you can convince yourself that you can never get an insulator which has these particular quantum numbers. Okay, I'll describe that in more detail later. This has to have some band touching. In other words, there should be something like Dirac points or Dirac nodes somewhere in this band structure, so it's not completely insulated. So in fact, when they looked off these high symmetry lines, they found some particular momentum where there is a band touching, where there's a Dirac point. Okay, so this is an example of a three-dimensional system which has these band touchings or Dirac points. There are several of them. There are several of these Dirac points. Each high symmetry point has got six of them, I guess. But it turns out they're all related by symmetry. Okay, so if you pick any two of these Dirac points, I can find some symmetry transformation that will take one to the other. Okay, so that means they're all at the same energy. And in particular, that also means they're exactly at the chemical potential. Okay, so it's very much like graphene. Graphene, you have two Dirac points. They're related by symmetry. So the chemical potential is at the Dirac point. Okay, here there are many more. But the same argument tells you that all of these Dirac points are exactly at the chemical potential.
The gap elsewhere is large?
The gap, you know, of course, near the Dirac point, there's no gap.
Elsewhere, because in the particular lines you have.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, over here, it's not that large. For example, this high symmetry direction, it's around 0.1 electron volts. It's not, you know, very large. And I think it's more or less consistent with the resistivity data. It's kind of we'll talk a little bit more about that. Because anyway, this made us go back and try to study the properties of Dirac points, but in three-dimensional systems. Okay, and it turns out it's not really been discussed that much, at least in the condensed matter context. And there's something very interesting about three-dimensional Dirac points, which I'll kind of go over in this slide. So let me say I picked just one of these Dirac points. Okay, so the dispersion near this Dirac point is simply linear in the momentum. And there are two bands that touch. Okay, so you have the Pauli matrices, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, that you can use to expand any 2x2 Hamiltonian. Okay, so actually, strictly speaking, this is not a Dirac fermion. So Dirac fermion in three dimensions should have four components. So strictly speaking, this is a Weyl fermion. We should be saying we're talking about three-dimensional Weyl points. Okay, they're just two-component fermions because the operators that act on them are 2x2 matrices. Okay, and it turns out magnetic order is important to get the simple structure, to get a system which has inversion symmetry with these sort of band touchings. Okay, now this, in a certain sense, these three-dimensional Dirac points are topological. Okay, and I'll try to convince you of that. So why do we think of them as being topological objects? Well, first of all, there's a charge that's associated with them. Okay, if I think of this as like a Zeeman splitting, there's some vector that gives me the Zeeman splitting. If I draw that vector around these points, they're either all pointing out or all pointing in, look like hedgehogs or anti-hedgehogs. And depending on the sign of them pointing out or in, you can say it's plus or minus charge. Okay, so there's also a stability associated with these Dirac points. You can't get rid of them. The only way you can get rid of them is to combine a plus charge with a minus charge. Okay, so that's very different from two-dimensional Dirac fermions, like in graphene. Graphene, you can open up a mass gap if you break some symmetry. Okay, you break inversion symmetry, you can open a mass gap. If you break time reversal symmetry, you can open a mass gap, and so on. Okay, over here, the only way you can open a gap, remove these Dirac points, is by allowing for scattering from this Dirac point to the other one. Okay, in other words, bringing them to the same point in momentum space, then they can annihilate. No. So in fact, we don't have time reversal because we're inside this magnetically ordered phase. Right? So in fact, it's important to break time reversal symmetry. If you have inversion, you have to break time reversal symmetry. Okay, so finally, you can. Yeah, so actually you don't, the inversion symmetry comes in and keeping these exactly at the chemical potential. If you break the inversion symmetry, they're off the, you know, they won't be exactly at the chemical potential and not at the same energy. But locally the band structure looks the same. So you don't need any symmetry actually. They are completely protected. The only thing you need is translation symmetry to keep them apart in momentum space, to say there's a right and a left drag point.
But
so if you have any kind of breaking of translation symmetry, so you have to then you have to ask what does it mean to have Dirac points, right? When you say Dirac point, you're talking about some structure in momentum space. So if you lose that, you know, this gets more and more fuzzy. So it's like you take graphene, you add disorder to it. It's the same as any metal, right? Yeah, so actually there is a Chern number, I'll talk about it in a minute, yeah. But it requires that you can define a momentum space, right? Okay, so finally what I'll show you is there's another feature of these wild points or Dirac points that was not, at least we didn't see in the literature before. They're actually associated with surface states. Okay, and these surface states can never arise in two-dimensional band structures. Okay, so that's another reason to think of them as being topological objects. Okay, so a couple of points that I want to make before I talk about these surface states. Well, people talk about Dirac metals like bismuth, Dirac semi-metals, but this is rather different because in bismuth they're really Dirac-like, they're four-component objects, these Dirac fermions, and you can easily gap them. In fact, they're gapped in bismuth. Okay, or people talk about similar Dirac physics in two dimensions in graphene. Again, it's not as topological as these objects because you can gap it out by some symmetry breaking. And finally, these Dirac points and wild points in three dimensions, the density of states is so small as you approach the wild point that, in fact, the conductivity will vanish as you go to zero temperature. So unlike in two dimensions where you get a finite conductivity, here this is really insulating like at low temperatures. Okay, so what about these surface states? So let me set up a simple problem. Instead of having all these different points, band-touching points, let me say I've just have two of these Dirac points with charge plus and minus. That's the minimum number, right? And this is inside some three-dimensional Brillouin zone. And I want to look at surface states. So let me say I take a surface along this perpendicular to the z direction. And in fact, what Ari noticed is that there must be surface states associated with this structure. So if I look at the surface Brillouin zone, and I'm exactly at the chemical potential, I can define surface states everywhere except at these two points. So these two points are the projection of this, of the three-dimensional Dirac points, where I have low energy excitations in the bulk. Okay, so I put an electron at these momenta, they can leak into the bulk. You can't really define surface states. But everywhere else, I can define surface states. And it turns out the surface states that I get take the form of a Fermi arc. Okay, so you have low energy excitation in the surface everywhere along this line, so that forms like a Fermi surface, but the Fermi surface doesn't close on itself. Okay, so this is a spectrum that you can never get in a two-dimensional system. Okay, in two-dimensional systems, if you have a Fermi surface, either it has to close on itself, or it has to go to the corners of the Brillouin zone and form an open Fermi surface. Right, so, but over here, what you have is this arc of the Fermi surface that ends at these locations where you can no longer define surface states. Okay, so it's important that you have these sort of singularities in your Brillouin zone to get this definition. Okay, so so again, there's some aspect of this topological insulator physics over here, surface states that are unusual. And on the top surface, for example, if you have this arc, on the bottom surface, you have the rest of the Fermi surface. You have the other arc that completes the Fermi surface. Okay, so it's an interesting question. What is the phenomenology of such arcs? People have looked at the physics of Fermi surfaces, of closed Fermi surfaces, in things like quantum oscillations and so on. It'd be interesting to analyze what happens when you have these open, these arcs. Right? Okay, so that's the full spectrum of these excitations. At the Fermi energy, that's an arc, but you can follow it off the Fermi energy, and if there are questions, I can discuss what it looks like. Okay, so how do you prove the fact that you have these Fermi arcs? So I'll just do that in a quick slide. It was kind of referred to before. So the fact that you have these Dirac points, which are sort of singularities in this band structure, you can see that if you calculate the Berry flux. So if I take a surface in momentum space that encloses this point, on that surface I can calculate the Berry connection by the usual formula. You just look at the block states on that surface and look at the connection, the U1 connection of these states. And from that vector potential or that connection, you can derive a field strength, like a magnetic field. If you integrate this field strength over this closed surface that encloses one of these points, that integrates to plus one or minus one, depending on whether you enclose a plus or minus point. Okay, so you really have some non-zero churn number that's on the surface, and one surface that you could pick is the cylinder, if you like, that encloses one of these points. It has a non-zero churn number on when you integrate over the surface of the cylinder, and as a consequence of that, you can argue very easily that tells you there must be a surface state which takes the form of a Fermi arc that goes from one of these, the projections of one of these guys, to the projection of the other guy. Okay, you can just use quantum Hall physics and conclude that.
But you have, in some sense, interacting systems. So is it obvious what states they have to use to compute this topological invariant?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So the kind of state that we are looking at, of course, has interactions to get magnetism. But you can adiabatically connect it to a system, like a mean field system, where you have certain magnetic fields that's applied on every side, right, which mimics the magnetic order. And in fact, here, the symmetry they are breaking essentially is just time reversal symmetry. So there are actually no low energy excitations either. It's not even like you have Goldstone modes, which you would have in, say, if you spontaneously broke SU2 symmetry. So, so in a real system, it's important that there are correlations, there are interactions. But all of the universal physics, you can mimic it by some weakly interacting system.
So suppose I do that, I will calculate, say, a Green's function for your system in this limit, right? And this Green's function principle can have additional singularities due to the non-trivial frequency dependence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And usually you can define topological invariant using Green's functions, which will involve integration of a momentum and frequency space.
Yeah, no, you don't necessarily have to define it in terms of Green's functions. So let's say, for example, you have a quantized response, right? You just calculate that quantized response in the interacting system. And in a free system, maybe it has some expression in terms of Green's functions. In the interacting system, it may not. But the response itself is well-defined. So in fact, this state has some sort of quantized response. If I have time at the end, I can tell you that. You know, these wild fermions have a chiral anomaly, so there's a way of defining some sort of response which will capture the same physics. But also, I can argue that the surface states are, you have these kind of surface states. You had weak interactions, definitely stable to these interactions, right? So you can go and look for a quasi-particle pole that looks like this in frequency and momentum.
So you're saying that basically interactions do not modify the Green's function too much?
No, they might modify the Green's functions completely. Right, but it's
quasi-particle pole.
Oh yeah, yeah. So for the surface states, yeah, if you have actually a well-defined quasi-particle excitation, yeah, then that pole should survive just from Fermi liquid theory and from those kind of arguments.
Yeah. I have a follow-up question because the way I understand the previous question is that what's the invariant language which would work for interacting systems as well, because you're using essentially single particle language.
Right, right.
And the response which you mentioned is sort of bottom line, the final product.
That's right, yeah.
It looks like something is missing is in between, be it a Green's function or any other language, but there should exist something allow you to express the very same idea for a system with interaction.
Yeah, so the cleanest formulation is a response. Just like in quantum Hall effect, you have a quantized response. That's the cleanest formulation. But it may not be the only one. For example, I think the stability of surface states is also a different way of arguing.
Just why I would be uncomfortable with the response, because it's the bottom line. It's the result rather than the way of seeing it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, but the only worry is it may be overly restrictive. That's the worry. Is there other states which are obviously distinct, topologically distinct with interactions, but for which you cannot formulate a simple response, right? I think that could happen. Then maybe one has to look at things like, actually I'll go on, there's some I can tell you about an example where we think that there are states that are distinct in terms of even in the presence of interactions, but we don't know of any quantized response that, you know, which can tell them apart. But yeah, let me. Okay, so for the experimentalists in the audience, maybe there's no, I guess there's no experimentalists in the audience. This is what, if you were to actually go and look at the surface of this material, this is what we predict you would see. These are the different Fermi arcs you would get, many more of them because there are more drag points. Again, it really is a surface-dependent property. There are some directions along which you don't have surface states. Okay, so this is the phase diagram that we proposed as a function. So let me ignore this y-axis. This is the interaction, the correlation strength. The correlations are weak, you have a metal. Correlations are very strong, you have a Mott insulator. But we believe we're somewhere in between where you have this Dirac semi-metal phase, wild semi-metal maybe more appropriately. But it turns out there's another phase that we don't quite stabilize, but which we believe the real system could actually exhibit. So our method is actually biased against these kind of gap phases. And that's called a pi axion insulator. So I'll explain what this terminology means. So it's an insulating phase, a truly insulating phase, unlike this Dirac metal, semi-metal. But it has some, in some way it's distinct, it's also magnetically ordered. Okay, the same magnetic order persists throughout this phase diagram, but in some way it's distinct from the Mott insulator. So I'll try to tell you what this is. It comes back to the question about quantized responses. Okay, so let me say I have a completely gapped insulator. So this, changing topics slightly, this is trying to define this other phase, this what I call the axion insulator. Okay, so so let me say I have some insulating piece of material. It's gapped in the bulk, but I'm also going to demand for this particular slide that it has no surface states. Okay, it's completely gapped. Okay, so when it's completely gapped like that, you can ask what its electromagnetic response is. Okay, the electromagnetic response must be non-dissipative. There are no low energy excitations that can give you dissipation. So it'll have some simple electromagnetic response. And what was shown is that one particular electromagnetic response you can look at is if I apply a magnetic field, B, I can ask what is the electrical polarization that's generated. Then if you break enough symmetries, you can have some electrical polarization that's generated as a consequence of putting on this magnetic field. Again, the two are related by some dimensionless number theta. The dimensions work out like that, but there's some dimensionless number theta that relates the two. Okay, now obviously this theta is odd under time reversal. B goes to minus B under time reversal, the polarization is fixed. So it's an odd function under time reversal. So you might think, if for a moment I had a time reversal invariant system, you would think that this theta must be zero. Okay, but it turns out that actually theta is only defined modulo 2 pi. So there are two solutions to this equation. There's theta equal to zero, but theta equal to pi is also allowed solution. Again, the reason it's only defined modulo 2 pi is because you're looking at polarization. If I take all the atoms in the system and move them by one lattice unit, you really can't say if you've done anything or not. Okay, and it's related to that fact. So in fact, there's another solution, theta equal to pi, which is allowed. And this is really what occurs for topological insulators, if you get rid of the surface states. Okay, so if you're a theorist, you can get rid of surface states by using periodic boundary conditions. Right? There are no surfaces. If you're an experimentalist, you have to work harder. You've got to do something like add magnetic impurities or break the time reversal symmetry, but only on the surface. Okay, and that doesn't affect the bulk properties, and that's another way of seeing this theta. So for topological insulators, it's a nice observation, but it requires some work to expose. Okay, but there's another way of situation where this you can look at this equation is when you have inversion symmetry. Okay, so under inversion symmetry, the polarization changes sign, but not the magnetic field. So you can run the same argument, and you can conclude that if you have an insulator that has only inversion symmetry, say no time reversal symmetry, just inversion, again, you should have zero, and the only allowed values for this theta are zero and pi. Okay, and the nice thing over here is that you don't have to work hard to get rid of the surface states. Typically, they don't have surface states. Okay, so the theta equal to pi value, I'll call this axion insulator, pi axion insulator. Okay, so that was the phase that I was mentioning over here. So what this phase diagram looks like, we had this Mott insulator at large U, and all of these, in all these cases, I have inversion symmetry. So once I have an insulator, I can ask what is its response under this what is its theta value? And because you have inversion symmetry, the answer is either 0 or pi, right, if you have an insulator. Mott insulator, you can convince yourself it has to be 0. Okay, there's a caricature of the Mott insulator where on every side you have a completely localized fermion. So theta has to be equal to 0. There's no motion of the electrons around in this lattice that can give you a non-zero theta. Okay, but on the other hand, what we find is that at small u, you also get an insulator, but for which theta is equal to pi. Okay, that was this axion insulator that we talked about, we mentioned. So really, this what's happening as you tune down this u value is that this Mott insulator wants to evolve into this theta equal to pi insulator. And the only way it can do that, it turns out, is by creating these Dirac Weil points. Okay, it creates, from this high symmetry point, a set of these band catchings. They move across the Brillouin zone, and then they annihilate, and then you get back an insulator. But in this process, you've transformed this theta from 0 to pi. Okay, so it would be very interesting also if we could realize this phase. It may actually be in this material or in some other set of materials, a magnetically ordered insulator where inversion symmetry protects this value of theta and makes it large, right, and allows it to be large. Okay, so another point that may be interesting to make is that usually we think of insulators like this. So this is an insulator that occurs at fairly weak coupling where you break time reversal symmetry. You think of such insulators, these are called Slater insulators. Okay, it's kind of like there's some spin density wave that made it an insulator. We always think of these sort of insulators connected to a Mott insulator. If you increase the correlations enough, they just adiabatically evolve into something where you can think of the electrons as living on the sides with some magnetic order. Okay, so usually you don't think of a distinction between these two. It's at least no qualitative distinction, some quantitative distinction. Okay, but over here, there's really a qualitative distinction. We can never get this into the Mott state. You can never get a Mott state of this value of theta. Okay, so this distinction is being preserved by the inversion symmetry. The fact that you're allowed only these two values, and the Mott state has to have a particular value. Yeah, so what I mean by a Mott state over here is that it's described by like a Heisenberg model, right? Or not necessarily a Heisenberg model, but spin Hamiltonian, where all the charge degrees of freedom are frozen out. So that Mott state will, I think, necessarily have theta equal to 0. So you need some degree of adnercy to get this theta equal to pi. So people have discussed topological Mott insulators, where you essentially take, so that is in the context of time reversal invariant systems, you take the topological insulator and you project it, if you like, to one electron per side. You get a spin model. So that actually has got trivial magnetoelectric response. There's no charge response, but it has some it's kind of a ghost Dirac cone and so on. It's in the spin sector. You see the physics of the topological insulator. As far as theta is theta goes, it's theta equal to 0. Yeah.
If I look in the bulk of this insulator and in the bulk of the topological insulator, they would be described by the same theta term, right?
That's right, yeah.
Is there like way to distinguish these two?
Well, this has magnetic order, right? This explicitly breaks time reversal. So that's a simple way to tell.
But as far as topological terms?
Yeah. So the electromagnetic response is not the only, you can't just look at that. Okay, so I have maybe 10 minutes, is it? So let me tell you a little bit about how we got to analyzing this particular model. What was the, for example, how do we know that a particular insulator is this theta equal to pi, or how we know that there has to be this Dirac kind of phase between the theta equal to 0 and theta equal to pi insulator? And that goes back to actually looking carefully at insulators that have inversion symmetry. Okay, so one important point to make is that inversion, unlike time reversal, is a symmetry that you can break by adding disorder. Right, so it's really a property of clean systems. So it won't be as robust as, for example, the time reversal symmetric topological insulators, which can be defined even in the presence of disorder. Okay, but many materials are sufficiently clean. And a lot of this physics goes over if you add a little bit of disorder. So let's talk about materials that have only inversion symmetry. So actually, inversion has been used before in classifying these topological insulators. What you do, you look at these special points in the Bilbao zone that are invariant under either inversion or time reversal. Okay, k goes to minus k. And because you have a modulus of the reciprocal lattice vectors, there are 8 of these points in the Bilbao zone. Okay, and you can go and look at, you can classify states at these special points by their eigenvalues under inversion, the parity eigenvalues. Okay, and if I give you a set of parity eigenvalues from that, it was pointed out by Fu and Kane, you can actually tell if a particular insulator is topological or not. Okay, when you have both these symmetries, both time reversal and inversion symmetry. Okay, so all they said is you look at these inversion eigenvalues, the number of eigenvalues which are negative, and the filled levels that have negative eigenvalues are always an even integer. That's because you have this Cramer's degeneracy. Each pair is doubly degenerate. So it has to be even, but it could be 2 times an even or 2 times an odd number. Okay, and when it's an odd number, it's 2 times an odd number, it's a topological insulator. So it's a very simple criterion that was already developed for systems that have both time reversal and inversion. Okay, so here what we did in this paper, and what was also done by Andre Bernaweg and his collaborators, was to look at systems that have only inversion, okay, no time reversal, and ask how we can classify these insulators, what are the topologically distinct insulators that you can get, and how we can tell which particular phase you're in. Okay, and so it turns out that there are just 2 distinctions between these insulators. One is that, 2 kinds of distinctions. One is that there are the Chern numbers, so they could show the quantum Hall effect because they don't have time reversal symmetry. So precisely the what nature of quantum Hall effect they show, that's one way in which you can classify these insulators. The other is these parities that I talked about. So insulators can differ in exactly what kind of parities they end up having. Okay, so the result that you get is, so if I give you some particular band structure with these different parities, these different time reversal invariant momentum parities, what you can prove very generally is that if you have an insulator, even without time reversal symmetry, this has to be 2 times an even number. Okay, and that was a bit of a surprise for us, but it's actually quite easy to prove. So you don't have an easy argument like Cramer's degeneracy. This is what the typical spectrum looks like at these time reversal invariant points. But you can still prove that if the thing is ultimately an insulator, it has to be, can only have an even number of minus parity levels. Okay, and then you can, again, define this theta in terms of these time reversal invariant parities. It again turns out to be whether this is 2 times an even or 2 times an odd number. If it's an odd number, you get this theta equal to pi insulator. Okay, and maybe the most surprising thing for us was, in fact, in deriving these results, what was very useful was using this concept of entanglement, which I'll quickly describe in the next 5 minutes. So it was actually useful to look at the entanglement spectrum of these systems as a quick way to establish these results. Okay, you can also do it without this technique, but we found it really useful to use this technique. Okay, so I guess this is the part that's relevant to this workshop. So what is entanglement spectrum? I don't think I need to spend too much time on this. Entanglement, bipartite entanglement of a quantum system, it's a property purely of the ground state. You don't have to look at excitations. You cut the ground, cut the system into 2 halves and trace out one of the sides, let's say the left half, and get a reduced density matrix for the right half. Okay, so why would one want to even think of doing this for topological insulators? It's easy to see there must be some signature. Okay, and the reason there must be some signature is that if you have a trivial insulator, you can think of that as electrons that are essentially bound to atomic sites. You can adiabatically transform any trivial insulator into a picture that looks like this, like an atomic insulator, independent atoms that are just put together. But if you have a topological insulator, something with non-trivial band topology, in some sense, the electrons have to be delocalized. Okay, there's no way in which you can adiabatically take this into that picture. Okay, that's why there's some non-trivial topology. Okay, so if I cut the system, you're necessarily cutting some states. Over here, you have a clean partition into 2 pure states. Here, you'll necessarily end up generating entanglement. And the question is, how do you see the entanglement? a crude measure like the entanglement entropy would really have no distinction between this and this phase. You'd still have the same kind of area law as you'd get for any gap system. So you have to have some, a finer way of looking at this, of the entanglement of these systems. And the tool that helps you over here is entanglement spectrum. Don't just look at a single measure of this density matrix. So I take that reduced density matrix and look at its eigenvalues. These are non-negative numbers, so I can think of this as exponential of some energy, some real energy. So these are the these are the energies of some fictitious spectrum called the entanglement spectrum. And if you look at these energies as a function of momentum, so if you have a cut that's translationally invariant, you can label all states by momenta along that cut. Okay, so you cut a three-dimensional system, you have two momenta at your disposal, the two momenta parallel to the cut, and you can plot these, essentially the eigenvalues of the density matrix as a function of these momenta. Okay, so you get something that looks a lot like surface states. The dimensionality is really the dimensionality of the surface that you have, and you can follow the evolution of these eigenvalues. Okay, and it was pointed out by Haldane and Lee that it's a useful way of looking at the fractional quantum Hall effect. That's a strongly interacting system, of course. But here, let's discuss what happens with a much simpler problem, just free fermions. Okay, so for free fermions, the calculation of this spectrum is highly simplified. Instead of calculating a many-body spectrum, you can calculate the analog of a single particle spectrum, some single particle energies, and then depending on how you fill up these single particle modes, you get the many-body energies, right? Just like you do for the energies of free fermion systems. Okay, so let me just show you some plots. We do this for some topological insulator, something that has both time reversal and inversion symmetry. So this is a plot of the energy versus momentum on the surface of the real physical spectrum, okay, the physical surface state, if I were to really cut the system. And here is an entanglement spectrum. This x-axis is the same. You get the same momenta as for a surface state. But these are not energies. These are really the eigenvalues of these single particle levels when I cut the system, okay, the entanglement modes when I cut the system. Okay, so you see that in both cases, there is this kind of Dirac point that you expect for topological insulator surface state over here, but it also shows up in the entanglement spectrum. Okay, so one thing you can very easily prove, which is proved in this paper, is that whenever you have a physical surface states, right, some protected surface states in a system, that will also show up, necessarily show up in the entanglement spectrum. Okay, and the way you prove this is that you can show that this entanglement spectrum is actually the surface states for a particular Hamiltonian. And the particular Hamiltonian is to take whatever band structure you have and flatten it. Okay, so you typically bands have some dispersion, but I can keep the eigenfunctions the same of all the filled bands, but make their energies all equal. So I get a flat band version of the original insulator that I started out with. In the process, you don't really change the topology because you just affect modes that are well away from the chemical potential. You never close the gap. So this, the final product that you get, this flat band Hamiltonian, should have the same topological properties as the initial Hamiltonian. Okay, so in this process, you remain in the same topological sector. If you had protected modes over here that reflect the underlying band topology, it should appear over here as well. Okay, that's sort of the... That's right, yeah. This is a topological insulator, but... That's right. But you know, if you had like quantum Hall systems, you just need charge conservation.
In your case, we need this parity
to protect this. So I'll come to that. But you know, if I took a quantum Hall system, we know it has protected surface states. What this theorem tells you is the entanglement spectrum will also have surface states. Yeah, but for the topological insulator, you have time reversal symmetry. You cut it, you have these surface states. You'll also appear over here.
So why is the spectrum symmetry
over here? Yeah, that's a good question. I'll come to that in a second. Yeah, it's a, so that was the I'll talk about it. Okay, so we proved it one way, right? If you have surface states in the physical system, the entanglement spectrum has got the same type of modes. But what about the converse, right? If I see some modes in the entanglement spectrum, doesn't necessarily mean there are surface states. Okay, so actually we have an example where this converse is not true. Okay, so take for example the same model that we started out with. So I didn't really specify the model. It's some tight binding model that has that shows a topological insulator phase, and break time reversal symmetry. Okay, so once you break time reversal symmetry, you don't have the topological insulator phase anymore. And in fact, if you look at this physical spectrum, you don't have any Dirac point in this physical spectrum. So this physical spectrum, you can adiabatically transform it away to a completely gapped spectrum where there are no surface states at all. So it's consistent with not having surface states at all. Okay, but if you look in the entanglement spectrum, in fact, the entanglement spectrum still has this touching, okay, this Dirac point. Okay, so what? So how is that protected? It's not being protected by this time reversal symmetry for sure. Something else is protecting it. Okay, so it turns out, and this is related to the question that Didier just asked, it's related to the fact that this looks particle-hole symmetric because there's another symmetry that's at play in this problem, and that's inversion symmetry. The particular model that we looked at had both inversion and time reversal symmetry. I broke the time reversal, but the inversion was still there. Okay, so it turns out the entanglement spectrum is better able to pick out, you know, the band topology of such inversion symmetric insulators than surface states. And the reason is that if I have a surface, it necessarily breaks inversion. Right? It's an inside and an outside, it breaks inversion. But it turns out when I do an entanglement cut, you still preserve inversion symmetry. Okay, the inversion symmetry is implemented in some non-trivial way, because under inversion, the subsystem you retain and the subsystem you trace out, they're interchanged. Okay, so inversion is implemented in a non-trivial fashion, but it's still there. Okay, and one way you can test that is to break the symmetry, and you'll find the spectrum is gapped. Okay, so there's a little bit of a gap because you break it weakly, but if you make it large enough, you can get rid of this thing.
So actually, this phenomenon is very similar like this APLT thing.
That's right,
when
yeah.
You break a time reversal, you still find this two-fold degeneracy protected by inversion.
That's right, yeah. This is a 3D version of that. That's right.
Well, what if you do the opposite? So you don't break time reversal symmetry, but you break inversion.
Yeah, so then you will still have these surface states. Physical surface states will be there because that's still a topological insulator. Right? You don't need inversion to define the topological insulator, you just need time reversal symmetry. But by the old theorem, you will also get entanglement modes with the same kind of spectrum. Right? But then what happens, it turns out it's not particle hole symmetric, but it's just a Dirac point that may be off at some non-zero entanglement energy.
So by breaking inversion symmetry, you are making A and B unequal, that's what you're doing?
That's right, yeah, yeah. You're not able to relate them by some transformation like that. Okay, so I guess I'm over, probably run out of time. But let me just conclude over here. So using this fact, the surface states are actually very useful in general for trying to classify band structures, because if you have some band structure you don't know if it's topological or not, you can just calculate it on a slab and look for surface states. That's much easier than trying to calculate a response like this theta response. Okay, now when you have inversion symmetry protecting your system, you really can't do that. There are no physical surface states, but you can use this entanglement spectrum and figure out which Hamiltonians are topological and which ones are not. Okay, which are protected by just this inversion. In fact, so that's how we derived all these results I talked about before, about classifying insulators with only inversion symmetry, and that was ultimately used in trying to figure out this the properties of that, the calculated band structures. Okay, one answer to a question that was asked before by Boris, it turns out you can use this entanglement properties to define versions of so this was a non-interacting calculation, but even in the interacting case, you can argue that some of these features are stable. Okay, and it has to do with the way in which this inversion symmetry is implemented. It turns out it's implemented as an anti-unitary transformation in this entanglement spectrum, and an anti-unitary transformation can square to plus or minus one. Right, and that's a very, it's a discrete, the answer to that is just discrete, you can't change continuously from one to another, and that is something that you can apply to the case where you have interactions. So there are some cases where this, sorry for this typo, but You can show this inversion acts as an anti-unitary symmetry of the squares to minus 1, which is consistent with having this Dirac point. Then in some cases, we really don't know of a simple physical response that corresponds to that. Okay, so let me, so those are my conclusions. The theme I wanted to talk about was how correlations plus spin orbit give rise to novel phases. The actual example was this topological Dirac metal. Let me just stop over there. There's also some kind of quantized response one can associate with these wild fermions, which is a consequence of these chiral anomaly. If there are questions, we can talk about them. Let me stop here.
In your example, you do need this both translational symmetry and parity symmetry to protect the topological order, or you only need a translation?
Only a translation, yeah.
But in a later case, you show in terms of spectrum, this parity is also.
Oh, okay, so there are two different phases I talked about. One is a semi-metal, and one is a true insulator. So for the semi-metal, this Dirac semi-metal, you only need translation.
I see, I see.
For the insulator, the theta equal to pi insulator. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, when you say this parity, you imply this translation symmetry, right? Because.
And then for Dirac metal, you discussed that this kind of this spin defect, right?
Right.
Yeah,
in momentum space.
Yeah. So that defect has finite energy or divergent energy.
It's a defect of the band structure. I mean, it's not like a.
In real space, what kind of?
There's no obvious real space picture for it. It's like having Chern number in a quantum Hall insulator. You have Chern number. Right, it's like that. It's some property of the momentum space.
Question about these Fermi arcs you had. I mean, whenever you have two points, the connectivity is clear. But in your specific example, there were always three Dirac points.
Right.
How is the connectivity determined?
So the only rule is that the plus should connect to the minus. So you could have more than one pattern coming from that. And I think that depends on details. Sometimes, if you're close to a transition where things appear in pairs, you can figure out how they connect. But in general, you have to just work out
it's not a unique.
It's not unique. There are some rules, but it's not unique.
Well, at the end, you were implying that entanglement spectrum can classify tracking systems. So I was wondering if you can comment also on the paper by Kosky and Kitaya, where he studies this dimensional chains, and then this kind of classification breaks down.
Right. Yeah. So in fact, there's also a paper by Turner and collaborators, where I think the point both of these papers make is that if you just look at band topology, there's this integer classification, but if you add interactions, it breaks down to an eight-fold classification, and that you can see from this entanglement spectrum kind of argument. That if you try to look for invariants like the one I talked about, the square of the inversion operator to minus one, they don't use inversion, but the analog of that. If you look at the different representations that can have, there are just eight distinct ones. And those are the only ones that you know for sure are stable to interactions.
Yeah, so the chiral fermion anomaly you mentioned there, that equation.
Right.
The left-hand side, how do you define?
So it's the density of, let's say you just have a pair of these wild points, right, plus and minus. You can look at the density on the right minus the density on the left. So if you had. That's right, it's Valley-Kant. So translation invariance, you would think that's conserved, right? There's no scattering between the two. But it turns out there's this chiral anomaly. So if you go through a space-time process where this E dot B integrated has some non-zero value, it has to be an integer with these kind of boundary conditions. It tells you that the change in this number is that integer. So there's some pumping that you go from one to another. So I think in a way that can be used to define this phase. It's a response that you can use to define this phase, although it's gapless, right?
Thank you very much again.